after Saddam, then what? Because there is going to be a time after Saddam, one way or the other. A, he's going to become sick or get to be very elderly, and he's going to die. That's true no matter what happens. B, maybe short of that, he will be assassinated by members of his own army or perhaps some of the other people inside of Iraq. C, he is taken out in the war that is bound to ensue, and one of our rockets or bombs happens to catch him in one of his palaces and blows him to bits. D, he escapes to Tripoli or somewhere else where he's stashed away billions of dollars and has billions of dollars in Swiss and offshore bank accounts because he has ripped off the $14 million a day that the United States is paying him for his oil, which is allegedly supposed to be used for humanitarian purposes only. But a great deal of it is being skimmed off into Saddam and his family's personal pockets and their own numbered bank accounts. And that's why, when I was looking through some of the websites from Iraq this morning and saw the pictures of some of the little malnourished children in hospitals and grade schools over there, they claim that 800,000 children have died since the imposition of sanctions by the United States and the Allies. I don't know if that is true or not, but of course they blame us. They don't blame themselves for the rapacious attack upon Kuwait or what they did during the Iran-Iraqi war, protracted war of 8 solid years, or what they did in the northern part of Kurdistan when over 150,000 Kurds were mercilessly gassed to death and killed by chemical weapons. So, as you look at their own explanation of what's going on in Iraq, and I read the Iraqi version of history this morning on one of their websites, it's incredible a difference between our point of view, what we think we know, that of the British, that of the United States government, and that of the rest of the entirety of the world. Did you know that yesterday and the day before there were huge demonstrations all over Australia? Sydney, Melbourne, Perth. Thousands of people took to the streets, anti-war banners, don't get dragged into the war, don't fight Iraq on the part of the United States, peaceniks, people that want peace at any cost, at any kind of appeasement. And these are the victims of the Bali bombing, Australia. And they are demonstrating vociferously against the war. Well, you all know that our president, George W. Bush, went to the United Nations under an awful lot of pressure from what is called the nebulous concept of world public opinion. He would have been better off rather than going unilaterally because the world generally looks at the United States as a cowboy. You can understand, if I just touch on a couple of nerves right quickly, what the attitude of the United States or toward the United States is, especially in the entire Islamic world, and throughout all of Europe, all of Central and South America and Mexico, indeed almost all the world with the exception of Britain and some other little countries that don't really mean very much. And that is that we want to become the global cop. We want to be not only the world's only superpower, but a mega power actually able to dictate what kind of government, what kind of economic system, political system other nations are going to have. That's what they think about us. Summarized rather neatly by one young German teenage girl who was asked about what she thought about the war in Iraq. She says, all the United States ever does is go around and bomb everything. That came out of the experience of Kosovo and what the Germans and what the Europeans thought about what was going on in Kosovo and Yugoslavia, because we bombed Yugoslavia back into the 1950s. We took out their major bridges and did a tremendous amount of damage over there. So, we are treated now daily to the absolute ludicrousness of UN inspectors trundling off in their little white Volkswagen vans and going to the places which they announced in advance they were going to visit, the same sites that they visited 4 years ago, military sites and places where they are sure they're going to find something. I told my wife many, many months ago what a simple thing it would be to begin construction in what ostensibly is merely some kind of a neighborhood, but to actually be putting very deep, maybe concealed, 2- and 3-story bunkers beneath the ground, have families move in. Now I find out, the reports are coming in, and finally did get on the major news media, but it was on things like the Drudge Report and the Debka file and some of those that I have access to in our own news service that is maintained for me. that Saddam Hussein has actually urged, and probably under the threat of the death of their families, many of his own people in all levels of government to secrete things like, they call it MWD, weapons of mass destruction, WMD for short, weapons of mass destruction, chemicals, biological agents, maybe laptops, stacks of CDs, which can have all of the necessary details about how to build these weapons, how to build a nuclear device, and to secrete them inside people's private homes, on farms. How would you like to go looking in a nation the size of California for such things as a few laptops and a few barrels of some kind of chemical that could be stored among pesticides, herbicides, fungicides, or insecticides on some farmer's ranch somewhere in a nation that size? What do you think they're going to find? I mean, we're hearing Fox News have a question every morning, and they have people calling in, and they tell people what to think, and then they call people and ask them what they think. And then the people tell Fox what Fox just got through telling them the day before, and they give their opinion. Some lady in Florida, some man in Michigan, some guy in Oregon. They have got no more knowledge or special information or opinion that is any more valuable than your everyday little old lady in Arkansas on Social Security. They just don't know, but they give out with an opinion. And that takes up a lot of your morning. Now let me tell you some of the world public opinion that is very, very easy for the general public in many nations to believe. A, the United States wants to take over Iraq because we've got a terrible oil crunch. We've got an oil crisis. Our Congress, because they are stampeded by the environmentalists, is not given permission to go up in Alaska and to develop and to explore because of the caribou. We can't drill offshore anymore because of the possibility of environmental spills. And we've got to become more self-sufficient because we're way over 50% dependent upon foreign oil. So since Iraq has oil reserves second only to Saudi Arabia, and it is light sweet crude, it's a higher quality crude oil than comes from most parts of the world, the United States, with a president who owned an oil company and had been in the oil business and his daddy before him all of his life, and a vice president who was the CEO of Halliburton, one of the big oil companies, exploration and drilling. So, of course, we want to take over Iraq so we can set up a puppet government and we can get in on the ground floor. Well, let me tell you, China, Russia, Germany, all of Europe, and to some extent Japan, are convinced of that. So why do you suppose they were foot draggers when it came to the first resolution proposed by the United States, which the UN turned down, and which all of our other countries that we expect to be allies, other than Britain, also turned down? Germany, France, Russia, China. Because they saw it exactly as I just said. If the United States is in there and we go in unilaterally and we win a war and we are first on the ground, who is the first to follow U.S. troops? United States businessmen. And what kind of a business would they be in? The two major industries of Iraq are, number one, you know, oil. You know what number two is? Dates. Thousands of tons of dates. In the Shat el-Arab, which is the confluence of the Tigris-Euphrates, it's very swampy and it's very tropical down there, and there are hundreds of thousands of date palms, and that's their major export product. The United States is not interested in dates. We're interested in oil. So it's very easy for all these other third world countries to believe that. Now, a report I just read this morning says that Beijing is waiting with bated breath for the United States to become deeply enmeshed in a war which will drag on for perhaps weeks, if not months. A war which will feature the Iraqi columns retreating on Baghdad and the United States having to send in ground troops to become involved in urban fighting going door to door and house to house inside of Baghdad. And Beijing is waiting for an opportunity to attack Taiwan. With four U.S. battle carrier groups in the Persian Gulf and Eastern Mediterranean and the Red Sea, we don't have a carrier battle group in the Pacific. So we don't have any way to intervene if China decides to gobble up Taiwan. We are living in very serious times, so let me paint the scenario for you as to what could happen, actually what Saddam Hussein hopes will happen in the event we have to go to war against Iraq. The first thing he's going to do is to attack who? All of you know, Israel. But he's also received assurances from Syria and from the Hezbollah and Hamas that they expect to mount attacks, and there have been sophisticated weapons that have been actually purchased for the Hezbollah in the Bekaa Valley in southern Lebanon from the Chinese. And the Syrians have supplied them, so they know that they're supplied with Katyusha and even upgraded Katyusha rockets. And the Katyusha rockets are the ones you remember from World War II scenes of the Russians with their rocket machines, we're just sending them one after another. Well, they've got those in the Bekaa Valley. So what they hope to do is to get Israel involved in a war on about three or four fronts. With urban warfare, with attacks from within Israel, the West Bank, the Gaza Strip, the Golan Heights, the Bekaa Valley coming across from southern Lebanon, and Israel having to have its tank columns very, very busy, as it also is fighting off the effects of perhaps chemical and biological warheads that can be lobbed into major Israeli cities from Iraq. This is what Saddam Hussein hopes will occur if he is attacked. And you know very well he's capable of it because he did it before. And even though we were treated to propaganda that showed some of the Patriot missiles kind of skipping off a part of the engine, but it did not destroy the warhead of incoming Scuds, and that only happened a couple, three times, but there were a lot more than that, they did not prove to be effective, and the Scuds came raining down, and a lot of people died. And of course, he also attacked Saudi Arabia with them, and you know that he hit a, by accident, they're very notoriously inaccurate, but he hit a barracks where U.S. troops were stationed, and quite a number of them died as well. So the world is poised on the brink of evil intentions, not just Saddam Hussein. This world has grown to become a very dangerous place. The United States is very concerned about the nuclear program of the North Koreans. We need not be concerned. We can forget it. I forget how many there are, perhaps 40-some, but last time I checked, I'm not sure. Nuclear reactors busily producing megawatts of electricity in Japan. Most of you don't know that under license, a piece of paper in a file drawer somewhere, the Japanese have been building F-15 Strike Eagles. They call the new number one, not the zero, but the one. And I have seen pictures of them, and they are just identical to the F-15 Strike Eagle, 50,000 feet in 2 minutes straight up off the end of the runway. But they're identical in the sense that they're only in appearance identical, and the Japanese technology and all the equipment inside that aircraft is actually superior to much of that we have in the United States. Did you know that many of our guided missiles have Japanese-built components? There's no such thing as an American-made television set that I know of, maybe there is, but even the name on a Phillips had Japanese parts in the inside. The Japanese have swift and efficient battle tanks. They have got Aegis-type cruisers or destroyers or corvettes that are missile-carrying. They have quite an air force. I stated for about 35 or 40 years, and many thousands of people heard me say, the time is going to come when both the Germans and the Japanese will either reinterpret or rewrite their post-World War II constitutions, because it proscribed both of those nations from being involved in any kind of military attacks outside of their own borders for any purpose other than defensive purposes inside their borders. Well, of course, the Germans were involved in Kosovo. And the Germans were involved the last time we were in the Gulf War. All they did was send minesweepers to the Eastern Mediterranean. But they did send tokenism, token troops, and they have now rewritten their constitution, or at least reinterpreted it to the point that they can be involved, and they have already pledged to send some troops into Iraq if that is necessary as a part of a UN contingent. Well, all these governments want to have troops on the ground. Remember when the Russians beat us to the landing strip in Kosovo? You probably forgot that. It was fantastic. We should have landed people there immediately, but instead, as we were coming from the south, the Russians sent some big Antonovs in there, landed and took the perimeter of the most strategic airport inside of Kosovo, and once they plant their foot on the ground, they've got control. That's exactly what they intend to do next time. Now, consider Turkey. You know where that is, the Anatolian Peninsula. A lot of Americans don't know an awful lot about geography, but Turkey is a neighbor of Iraq. But you know where Kurdistan is? Kurdistan is an area roughly divided between Turkey in its northeastern borders Iran in its northwestern borders, Iraq in its northern border, and Syria in its northeastern border. And the Kurds are a unique and a separate people. They are descendants, apparently, from people that even preceded the ancient Persians. They have a language that is unknown anywhere else in the world. They have their own unique kind of social structure. The very wealthy among them are allowed two or three or four or five wives. They speak their own language. And they are very fiercely independent, and they have for centuries, you can go back and read the history of Iraq, wanted a separate nation. At one time, as a matter of fact, they did rule over quite a large area, and they want a separate state called Kurdistan. Well, because Turkey has a sizable Kurdish minority, and they've already had tremendous problems. There have been, I forget how many died, over 150,000, it seemed to me like, when just before we imposed the no-fly zones. A lot of Americans have forgotten that as well. But during the Gulf War, over 150 or perhaps 200,000 Iraqis tried to flee into Turkey. They fled across the northern border. They couldn't be taken care of. And thousands of them died of starvation and malnutrition and exposure. Now, Turkey is getting ready. They've got 80,000 tents and cots and enough to take care of about 80,000 people for a short period of time. And in the event of an attack against Iraq, Turkey intends to move 15 miles inside Iraq and have aid stations set up so that they have a safe and secure border, because they don't want those Kurds or other Iraqis pouring across into Turkey, which could add to a very restive minority and overthrow the Turkish government, which they don't want to see happen. So Turkey is involved to quite some extent. Now hang on to these thoughts, because I'm coming to something in the Bible that is just going to blow your mind. When you see some of the people who are in league together with what is about to happen in the Middle East. One of the real doomsdayers of our time is Daniel Ellsberg. Remember the Pentagon Papers? Well, Ellsberg was on a book signing tour in Florida the other day. And he was making an awful lot of doomsaying opinions. He believes that if we go to war, it is likely, absolutely likely, more than probable, that there will be the use of chemical, biological, and possibly even nuclear weapons. He believes that Saddam Hussein has the capacity to utterly destroy Israel. But if that is so, he knows that Israel could utterly destroy Baghdad, because Israel has far more than 1,000 multi-megaton nuclear warheads. He says that even by accident, if we think Saddam Hussein is hiding out in one of his palaces, or in some palace, or in a bunker in Baghdad, and we take our big 15,000-pound bunker-busting bombs, and we launch one, guided, right down into one of those 8-story deep bunkers, and if it happens to be a nuclear arsenal, that the nuclear bombs could all explode and wipe out an awful lot of the population of Baghdad, or of Iraq. He believes that Saddam will use poison gas against U.S. troops. And of course, Saddam is playing for time. He doesn't want us to attack in December. Doesn't want us to attack in January. Not even February. If we just wait till March or April, then all of the weather turns very bad over there. Cloudy and rainy, and it gets cold. Right now it is clear and dry. It was 104 degrees yesterday in Baghdad. And so he is stalling for time. And every time the gun is put to his temple, he manages some other dodge. He threatens here, he cajoles there, he wheedles, begs, and bargains. He, with his characters who have gone all over the world, and remember that Kofi Annan went there the last time there was a fright, and actually went in person, and lots of Germans have been over there, and lots of people at the second and tertiary levels of government have been over to Iraq, and the Iraqis have been busy in the world's capitals here and there as well. So, he believes that if poison gas is used against our troops, that we will retaliate with the same type of thing, and that hundreds of thousands of Iraqis will die. He believes then that the effect of that would be to instantly create hundreds of thousands of additional suicide bombers in the entire world of Islam. From Indonesia to Iran, to Jordan, to Egypt, to Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, wherever. And that is a possible scenario. Doesn't mean that that's going to happen, but that's what one of these people who looks at the world from a rather negative point of view thinks. I'm going to read Matthew 24, 1 to 8, the Olivet Prophecy. And as you turn to that, if you have your Bible, remember that The Bible is a Middle Eastern book. The Bible was written in the Middle East. It's about Middle Eastern peoples, and it looks out at the rest of the world from the vantage point of Jerusalem and the Middle East. This prophecy was given on the Mount of Olives. I spent overnight there on the Intercontinental Hotel back in 1966, just a few months before the 67 Six-Day War. My wife and I, and I think Mr. Norman Smith and his wife, and Lyle Christopherson, maybe there was another couple with us, I've forgotten so long ago. I've been on the Mount of Olives many times. I've taken my tape recorder and walked down among the olive trees. There's still some of the gnarled old trees there. And looking out at the world's most famous skyline, have done radio programs or television programs from on that site. So Jesus went out, departed from the temple, and his disciples came to him for to show him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, "See you not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." Well, for many decades, when Jordan possessed the old city, including the Mount of Olives and the Intercontinental Hotel, we were in the nation of Jordan, having driven there from Amman. We flew into Amman from Beirut. And all during that time, there was a no man's land imposed in late 1948 under the UN between the Israelis and the Jordanians. And there were sandbag gun emplacements, and you could see them with the muzzles of their machine guns and their helmets on, only a few hundred yards apart in the Valley of Kidron. And you were constrained to drive to an area where they would, it was just a dead-end road, and they would let you out of the taxi cab, and there would be barbed wire up about 8 feet high and a gate. And the taxi driver wasn't allowed to even carry our baggage across in a no-man's land, so we carried all of our baggage ourselves in a very hot, sweltering day. And we went through that barricade across no man's land, through another barricade, and lo and behold, we were in Israel. Now, since Israel captured the old city, they have never impeded any Arab from Saudi Arabia or Algeria. As long as they came through Jordan and came across the Allenby Bridge and got clearance, they could freely access what they call Harm al-Sharif, or the Dome of the Rock, or any other of the holy places like the Al-Aqsa Mosque. But all during Jordanian occupation of the old city of Jerusalem, the Jordanians did not allow a single Jew to approach the Wailing Wall. Why do I mention a Wailing Wall? Because the Wailing Wall is the only part of the temple that was there at the time that Jesus made this statement that still stands. And those huge stones are bigger than the side of a Steinway grand piano, and they are absolutely so conformable and so tightly put together that it's incredible. They are part of a huge wall that was like a fortress around the part where the temple once stood, which is today where the Gilded Dome of the Rock stands. So this prophecy that not one stone would be left atop another that shall not be thrown down did not come to pass. True, the armies of Titus destroyed Jerusalem in 70 AD. Hundreds of thousands of Jews were impaled, their bodies smeared with bitumen, and they were set afire to die in that horrible way. Josephus writes of it. You know that some of them fled to Pella. And you know that during that time, the Masada was a place where many Jews staved off the Roman armies for a lot of time and eventually had to commit mass suicide rather than fall into their capture. So it was a terrible chapter of history. But there were no heavenly signs, and Jesus Christ did not come. So when you read all of Matthew 24, you realize that there was a previous or a typical fulfillment, like a previous type of the great literal end-day fulfillment that is yet to happen, according to Matthew 24. So his disciples came and said, "Tell us, when shall these things be?" Back in about August of last year, I think I was over in, I'm forgetting where I spoke at that time, it may have even been Norfolk, but it could have been somewhere else, and I was going through some of this, and I was saying that it would be exactly like saying to someone today with a familiar New York skyline, that that's just like saying that the Twin Trade Towers would be lying flat on the ground. And I had not the remotest idea. I was merely making an analogy of someone that is so mesmerized, as somebody from the flatlands of Kansas might be, going to New York City for the first time and looking up at those 100-story buildings, of looking at all of this fantastic skyline, the most famous one in the world today, certainly. And that buildings of that size lying flat on the ground, that's just how preposterous that would have sounded to the disciples of Jesus Christ when that statement was made. How can something so enormous, great columns that it would take 5 or 6 men to join hands to encircle, and Robinson's Arch and the great court of the Gentiles before that magnificent stone temple that was so white and just looked like marble and alabaster, just a gorgeous structure. They couldn't believe it. Tell us, when shall these things be, and what shall be the sign of your coming and of the end of the world? The word coming does not mean coming again. The word coming means of your revealing or coming forth, of your presence. Because these young would-be revolutionaries hadn't the faintest idea in their minds that Christ was going to die, that they were going to become old men, that some of them would be martyred, that their bodies would molder in the grave for 2,000 years, and that Jesus still would not stand on the earth. They had no such idea. They were asking, what will be the sign of your ascendancy? What will be the sign of your accession to the throne? What will be the sign of your revealing yourself? Like epiphaneia is one word which is used. Apokalypsis is a word that means to unveil or to unfold or to reveal. They call it apocalypse and they think it means destruction. It means nothing of the kind. But the main one is parousia, which is used nearly everywhere for a presence or becoming to be. So that is what really they were asking. And he said, take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in my name, saying, I'm Christ. And that really the emphasis, not that many would say they are Christ, but many would say Christ is the Christ, and deceive many. And you shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you be not troubled. World War I is nowhere prophesied in the Word of God. The Hundred Years' War was never prophesied in the Word of God. The Crimean War was not prophesied in God's Word. The wars between the Seljuk Turks and the Mamelukes and others never prophesied. The time of Saladin never prophesied. All of the wars that ripped Europe apart for centuries never prophesied. World War II is nowhere in the Bible except in a shadowy reference possibly to Adolf Hitler as a type of Antiochus Epiphanes in the first half of the 11th chapter of Daniel. There is no prophecy whatsoever that said that Gulf War number one was going to take place, no matter what some people say about Nostradamus. There are no prophecies in the Bible other than this one, wars, plural, that means here and there, everywhere around this earth, and rumors of wars, and of course that's the time in which we live right now. Rumors of wars can cost billions of dollars, can cause the dislocation of hundreds of thousands of families, can cause economic duress to the point that the stock market takes a nosedive, can cause all kinds of disruptions in our modern technological society. And we're living in such a time. See that you, his disciples, be not troubled, for these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines, and there are, and there have been. What about the United States trying to go to Mogadishu to bail out people who were starving because of warlords that would not even allow the distribution of food that was sent to them in some of the northern provinces over there? Nation against nation, pestilences, famines. Pestilence could be man-caused as well as simply caused as a result of the spread of disease. And what about AIDS? And what about the reoccurrence here and there around the United States of bubonic plague? And the fact that Saddam Hussein is developing cultures which could spread bubonic plague, as well as the Ebola virus. He sent people down to Africa to get samples of blood and tissue and bring it back and work on the Ebola virus inside Iraq. He has VX, he has sarin, he has all these terrible things, a drop of which on the back of your hand can kill you. And it is known that he had them, and it's known that he still has them. He's merely had plenty of time to hide them somewhere. And earthquakes in diverse places. There's been an increase in earthquakes and volcanic activity recently as well. All these are the beginning of sorrows. Sir Winston Churchill said when Operation Torch took place during early part of World War II and the United States and Britain landed in North Africa, he said, this is not the end. And he said, it isn't even the beginning. but it may be the end of the beginning. And maybe that's where we are in terms of the Great Tribulation. We're at the end of the beginning. The beginning is upon us. There's no question about the conditions in this world today and what might occur. A parallel account is found in Luke 21:5-11. I won't read it all, but some talked of the temple adorned with goodly stones and gifts. And he said, verse 6, "For all these things which ye beheld, the days will come, into which there shall not be one stone left upon another that shall not be thrown down." And they said, "Master, but when shall these things be? What sign will there be when these things shall come to pass?" And he said, "Take heed that you be not deceived, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ. And the time draws near. Go ye not therefore after them. But when you shall hear of wars and commotions, be not terrified, for these things must first come to pass, but the end is not by and by. Then said he unto them, Nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and great earthquakes shall be in divers places, and famines, and pestilences, and fearful sights and great signs shall there be from heaven." That part has not occurred yet. We went through the Leonid meteor shower the other day, but that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about fearful sights where people actually think that the moon has turned to blood and the sun is black as sackcloth of ashes, as the Bible said. Now turn to Zechariah 12:1-3. It would do the United States well to take heed to these words, but of course the government pays no attention to the Word of God or the Bible. For that matter, it would do all the Arab nations very well to take heed to these words too. Zechariah 12:1-3. "The burden of the word of the Eternal for Israel, saith the Eternal, which stretcheth forth the heavens and lays the foundation of the earth and forms the spirit of man within him." The Bible talks about the spirit of man, the human spirit, but not the soul. The human spirit becomes unconscious when the body dies, unlike the pagan doctrine of the immortality of the soul, which has a conscious soul. But there is a human spirit. So he goes on to say, "Behold, I will make Jerusalem a cup of trembling unto all the people round about, when they shall be in the siege, both against Judah and against Jerusalem. And in that day I will make Jerusalem a burdensome stone for all people. All that burden themselves with it shall be cut in pieces, though all the people of the earth be gathered together against it." Even though the 11th chapter of the book of Revelation says that the two witnesses are going to prophesy in that great city called Sodom and Egypt, where also our Lord was crucified, the word really is stalos, I mean affixed to an upright pail. So in one sense, Jerusalem is the apple of God's eye. In another sense, right now, it is repugnant to him because of all of its sins. But it is going to be God's own capital. It is going to be the head, the capital of the universe, the throne of Jesus Christ, who will rule all the world from Jerusalem once that old city has been completely obliterated and the new Jerusalem comes down out of heaven from God. And Christ will rule from there. Revelation 17:12-14, three verses. Let me just tell you a little story as you're going to that chapter. If you knew the following, there is a God, and these three verses are His Word, and that's all you knew. If you didn't know anything at all about the Old Testament, you knew nothing about the New Testament, you had only a scrap. Let's say that you're on the proverbial desert island and a bottle floats ashore and you take the cork out and there is a scrap of the book of Revelation with three verses in it. Look how much you could know about what to look for and what is going on in the world if you only had these three verses. "And the 10 horns which thou sawest are 10 kings." You don't know who saw. You don't know when he saw it. But here, God, you know that God exists, and you believe this scrap is His Word, is saying that some person, saw 10 horns. And those 10 horns represent 10 kings. Well, you've got the good sense to know that a king is an autocratic ruler, that he's like a dictator. He's in complete power and control of the economy, of all of his people, of the raw materials, that there's no voting. He is a royal autocrat, and he rules as a result of succession. So the Army, Navy, Air Corps, Marines, whatever, does exactly what that king tells them to do. 10 of them, which have received no kingdom as yet. So you know they are separate. There are 10 of them. and they have not coalesced to form a great big ten-nation kingdom, not yet. These have one mind. Now that means one goal, one purpose. They have complete agreement. They have the same motives. And they shall give their power and strength unto the beast. Well, then the beast must be all ten when they come together, because it says they receive power as kings 1 hour with the beast. So the beast is A, man, B, an animal of some kind, C, it is applied to an agglomeration of ten nations or ten kings. But it's one of those, you know that. These shall make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb shall overcome them, for he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and they that are with him are called and chosen and faithful. So the Lamb is the Lord of lords and the King of kings. And since you believe in God and you believe this little scrap is part of God's word, you know this must refer to very God, the deity in heaven, Lord of lords, King of kings, coming to this earth. And when he comes to this earth, these ten nations are going to fight against him. So what do you have? You have a date almost. You can extrapolate backwards. You can go to the time, which you do not know the day or the hour, of the second coming of Christ. And you know that at the time of the second coming of Christ, there will be somewhere on this earth extant ten nations having coalesced together to become such a superpower that they actually think they can defeat the armies of the descending Christ as he's coming back to this earth. You can learn all of that from three verses in the Bible. How does that square with the concept that is taught in most of the churches and what most people think about a rapture, about all kinds of ideas involving prophecy? Now, go to Daniel, the 11th chapter, verses 40 to 45. And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him. If you were to read all of Daniel 11 and look at all the references in Rawlinson's history and Rawlinson's Five Great Empires and Dorothy Ruth Miller's The Ancient History in Bible Light, some of the other references such as Bible dictionaries and Bible handbooks and Bible commentaries on the history that is revealed in the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel, you would know that after the death of Alexander the Great, even prior to his burial, that his four generals divided up his kingdom into four different parts, and that an earlier chapter in Daniel actually spells that out and shows that that would take place. And the two of them ended up being Laomedon of Syria and Ptolemy Soter, P-T-O-L-M-E-Y, Soter of the Ptolemaic, which was a lesser line of pharaohs, rulers in Egypt, and the Seleucidae, or the Seleucids, of Syria. And that wars were raging back and forth between these two peoples, always across the land of Palestine. And the Jews were right in the middle of it all. But it comes down to a time where Antiochus Epiphanes is revealed, and that is made clear in Rawlinson's, and it's very clear if you study the history of that time and look at the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel. People called him Epimenes because that was a despective term that meant crazy. Antiochus gave his name to the city of Antioch, and his wife gave her name to a city in the area that is actually mentioned among the seven churches of Revelation, believe it or not. And so this man, who was like an insane warmonger, is depicted as a man who came in during a time of peace, who obtained the kingdom by flatteries, and he succeeded a man named Heliodorus, and Heliodorus was a tax collector. And the tax collector is mentioned in the 11th chapter of Daniel. Interestingly enough, the Hohenzollern family, if you go across Europe, anymore they're gone, I think, because of United Europe, but formerly you would come to a sign that would have a barrier across the road and it would say Zoll, Z-O-L-L. Well, that meant customs. And so you had to stop and you show your carnet, which is the big packet they give you for your rental car, includes your passport and all that type of thing. Pay a little fee, and you can go through. Well, Hohenzollern meant tax collector. And Kaiser Wilhelm was of the Hohenzollern line. And so the next great leader in Germany to come along succeeds the previous dictator of World War I, and the World War II dictator becomes Adolf Hitler, who is insane, possessed of the devil himself, perhaps. And he is typified by Antiochus Epiphanes in the middle of the 11th chapter of the book of Daniel. Now it says, at the time of the end. Now this is not back sometime in the Middle Ages, or back at the time of the Seleucidae. This is at the time of the end. Shall the king of the south, anciently that was an Egyptian. He was Ptolemy Soter, and he waged war against Antiochus Epiphanes. And the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind. Well, Adolf Hitler invented what is called Blitzkrieg, or lightning war, where tank columns would just go right through, get in the rear of another army and surround it, and they'd have no recourse but to surrender. And you all know that he used paratroopers for the first time in history, that he used such things as amphibious landings in Norway and paradrops at the same time, and that the world actually entered a whole new era with the kind of warfare that Adolf Hitler instituted and implemented. Shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots, you can read tanks, and horsemen with many ships. He shall enter into the countries, plural, and shall overflow and pass over, not in one country, but transcending national borders. He shall enter also into the glorious land, that's Palestine, the modern nation of Israel. And many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom. And if you look it up in the Bible, it says Edom is Esau, and Esau is Turkey. So the king of the north does not attack, subjugate, or occupy Turkey, but has to come either through it or around it, over it, or through the Mediterranean, or across the Bosporus Dardanelles from European Turkey, and across down into Palestine. Turn to the 83rd Psalm, one of the most unlikely places in all the Bible to find a fantastic prophecy. And yet, here is a fantastic prophecy. A song or psalm of Asaph. Keep not thou silence, O God, hold not thy peace, and be not still, O God, for lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. There is no more hatred against the Bible, against the Jews, against the proprietors of the Old Testament, against the writers of the Psalms, than exists among Islam. They hate the Christian religion. They hate the Christian Bible. They hate the Jews. And they know the Jews get their religion, the way they look at it, from the Old Testament, supposedly. For lo, thine enemies make a tumult, and they that hate thee have lifted up the head. They have taken crafty counsel against thy people, and consulted against thy hidden ones. They have said, come, and let us cut them off from being a nation, that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance. And that is written into the charter of the PLO. That is exactly what is the desperate desire in the breast of every Islamic adherent in the world, to completely annihilate the Jews, every last man, woman, and child, and to destroy the nation of Israel. Now, time out. Did you know that the Arabs in Palestine were offered an Arab-Palestinian state by the United Nations in 1947. Did you know that? Well, if you were born then, you might have, but probably have long since forgotten it. But it's true. After the world finally got a conscience following the revelation about Hitler's camps at Auschwitz, Dachau, Buchenwald, Baden-Belsen, and all the others, Majdanek, and the extermination of nearly 6 million Jews, hundreds and hundreds of thousands in Buchenwald and Auschwitz, all by themselves, where the crematoriums were busy, and they were being gassed with Zyklon in what was supposed to be a shower room. Finally, when some of those refugees came out of that, and I've seen the pictures of Eisenhower himself with some of the colonels and soldiers there entering into the death camps with the bulldozers that were shoving thousands of bodies that are like sticks with bloated bellies and little thin, and you see the feet and the heads and all that grotesque, and there are bulldozers that are actually bulldozing mounds of human corpses, and yet there are people that try to rewrite history and say none of that happened. But those top generals of the United States would walk into a camp like that and turn and vomit, because it was just overwhelming to them. They couldn't stand it. So finally the world found its conscience. Well, it looked the other way, didn't want to believe it. Oh no, they couldn't be doing that. They couldn't be exterminating Jews. They couldn't be actually trying to get rid of Jews in Poland, Romania, Hungary, Bulgaria, in all of Germany, in Italy, in France, in occupied France at least. They couldn't be doing that. No, they couldn't be. But they were. So finally, when the Jews began to try to flood into Palestine, a homeland, because for generations, the old Jewish family, the old grandfather at the head of the table would always toast their meal by lifting a cup and saying, next year in Jerusalem. Next year in Jerusalem. So finally, those refugees that fought their way to southern France and were clogging the ports from Brindisi all the way to southern France, waiting for some old rusty tub or a bucket that would be chartered by someone. You ought to see the movie Exodus, written from the book by Leon Uris of the same title, and read it of what happened during that day. The British operated a series of forts all the way up and down the length of Palestine and Israel, where the Jews were, modern-day Israel, that didn't exist as yet. And they were under attack by the Irgun, that was actually a Jewish freedom fighter, characterized by the Arabs as terrorist organization. So was the Palmach and so was the Haganah. And some of the leaders of the Israeli government later on, including a couple of prime ministers, actually were members of the Irgun. And they would assassinate or they would capture British officers and hold them in trying to force their way to have a state. In a lot of ways, the Arabs can see a parallel between what the Jews were doing in 46, 47, and early 48 with what they're trying to do today, and they justify it based upon that rationale. Well, the UN had had enough of it. And so, based upon the Balfour Declaration from Britain, Lord Balfour was a Jew, member of Parliament, and he wrote the declaration, you can read it on the internet or get it in your history books, that a Jewish homeland ought to be created, but at the same time and alongside, as a part of the same proposition, an Arab state of Palestine. But who controlled Palestine? Well, Syria had the Golan Heights. Didn't want to let it go. Quite an agricultural area up around Quneitra, and I've been there. And, of course, Egypt had the Gaza Strip that, like a dagger into the soft underbelly of Israel, is all along the seacoast of the Mediterranean and actually an extension of the Sinai. And Egypt had the Sinai and the Gaza Strip. But Jordan, now Jordan had the old city. And along with the old city was Bethlehem. And so who knows how many hundreds of millions of dollars were spent every year by British, Americans, Europeans of all stripes, Central and South Americans, people from all the Latin world that are Catholics, who would make a pilgrimage to the holy places of Christendom during Christmas, Easter, and so on. Jordan didn't want to let that go. So there were three major Arab nations, Syria, Egypt, and Jordan, that said, no way. And there wasn't any infrastructure among the Palestinian Arabs. There was no government, there was no PLO, there was no organization to speak for them as if with one voice at all. And so the nations and the Arabs in Palestine said no. They turned it down. But they would have had a Palestinian state larger than the one that is being proposed by some of the peacenik prime ministers of Israel that have been in place over the years trying to trade land for peace. They would have had a larger state than the one they're going to end up with if that plan ever takes place. A lot of people need to go back and read their history, need to understand that during the Caliphate of Baghdad for over 700 years, not one single mention, breath, or whimper, or whisper was ever made that the Palestinian Arabs ought to have a state. And from the end of World War II up until the time of 1948 when the Jews declared a state, none of the other Arab states said that the Palestinians ought to have a separate state. You know, Britain created Transjordan. It became Jordan and the Hashemites. They actually created it, just drew the lines on a map and said, this is Jordan. And that was following the British mandate in the area. It used to be under the protection of Britain many years ago. So they really don't have a historical and historical leg to stand on so far as the demand for a Palestinian state. Now, as I've said before, what happens if the state of Palestine becomes a state? What does a state have? Well, a state has sovereignty. A state is able to send embassies or ambassadors to embassies over 150 countries all around the world, including the Vatican. A state would have an international airport. That international airport could receive Antonovs from Russia, or it could receive airliners from China, or from Baghdad, Iraq, several times a day. No holds barred. No other country could impede that kind of travel, whether an international port, which they would have along the Mediterranean coast with Gaza, or an international airport. And what can be carried aboard some of those great big air pipes like an Antonov or a C-5A? Tanks, APCs, troops, guns, chemical and biological weapons, nuclear warheads, bombs, anything. So if a Palestinian state is created, it will actually be segregated, just like the Danzig Corridor segregated Germany from Poland previous to World War II, and they would have to have some kind of access and a roadway of some kind between the two from the West Bank and the Gaza Strip because they're not contiguous. It would look like a gerrymandered kind of a map that some politician put together. It would be ridiculous, but that's what they want to take place. What do you suppose would be the very first thing that a Palestinian government in place in a Palestinian state would want to do? Start arming itself. Start raising an army and equipping that army because their goal would be the destruction of Israel. So that's why a lot of people in Israel don't want a Palestinian state. And other people in Israel that are short-sighted do. So it says, they have said, verse 4, come and let us cut them off from being a nation that the name of Israel may be no more in remembrance, for they have consulted together with one consent. They are confederate against thee. If there's one thing all Arabs and all Islamic people agree on, we hate the Jews and we want to destroy the nation of Israel. The tabernacles of Edom. Edom is Esau, which is Turkey. And the Ishmaelites. And Ishmael is the eponymous ancestor, the progenitor of all the Arab races. All 12 princes that become the Arab state, became the Arab states, are all descended from Ishmael. Of Moab, that probably means Iraq, and the Hagarenes, an East, Middle Eastern peoples, notice the name Hagar. And Hagar was a slave girl who was the mother of Ishmael. So the Hagarenes are nothing more than Middle Eastern Arabs that descended again from Ishmael. Gebal and Ammon. Gebal is not identified. I have no idea what that might mean today, but Ammon is the modern capital of Jordan. And so the Ammonites are people in Jordan. Again, people to the other side of the sea there, of the Jordan and the Dead Sea, are the peoples that are mentioned here. And Amalek, the Philistines, and the land of Palestine was named from the Philistines. They gave their name to Palestine. And the inhabitants of Tyre, and that's modern-day Lebanon. That's the coast of Lebanon, where Tyre, Seirs it's called today, is, and I've been there too. Asher is also joined with them. Fascinating. Asher is Assyria, which is modern-day Germany. And the king of the north is going to come, as we read, into that land like a whirlwind and occupy it. But it says certain ones are going to escape out of his hand. So take a look at that again over in Daniel, the 11th chapter. It says, he shall enter into the glorious land, verse 41, and many countries shall be overthrown, but these shall escape out of his hand, even Edom, that's Turkey, and Moab, and the chief of the children of Ammon, or Ammon, Jordan. He shall stretch forth his hand upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape, which makes me think perhaps it is an Egyptian who will emerge as the king of the south. And he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over all the precious things of Egypt and the Libyans. That is not modern-day Tripoli or Libya under Muammar Gaddafi. It is instead Put. And Put is Pakistan. Put is Afghanistan and Pakistan. And Ethiopians, that's Kush. Where are the Kush Mountains with the word Hindi in front of them? And the Pamir Knot and the Himalayas? Well, the Hindu Kush Mountains are in both Kashmir or northern India, or Pakistan, I should say, and also in Afghanistan. The Kushites dwell in that land. They will be at his steps, meaning at the farthest point of his advance. So it seems to say that even Saudi Arabia is going to be taken over by this northern power. And I wouldn't doubt that for a moment. But tidings out of the east and out of the north shall trouble him. Now China, Japan, Russia get involved. This is talking about world war. Talking about global war that is triggered by someone in the Middle East who pushes at a northern power called the beast. And that could be nothing short of an oil embargo. One of our outspoken congressmen in 1973, the early part, said, oh, the Arabs will never use oil as a political weapon. Along came the Yom Kippur War, on the Day of Atonement, 1973. And it looked for a time like the Israelis were going to have their backs against the wall and maybe succumb. And instead, they put together the most marvelous mechanism you ever heard of and waddled that thing across the desert in the Sinai. It was a huge system of gigantic rollers, huge big steel rollers. And the rollers were hooked together by cables, and they could drag them only so many feet during the day. And they got finally way down to the southern end of the Bar-Lev line. The Bar-Lev line was a series of berms and hardened hard spots of concrete gun emplacements built by the Israelis following the 67 Six-Day War along the Suez Canal as a buffer, a frontier battle area to keep the Egyptians on the other side of the canal and to protect the Sinai and therefore Israel. And the Bar-Lev line was 120 miles long. Well, they took these big rollers down there, approximately 60, 70 miles, way down south of the Egyptians, and the Egyptians didn't know about it because they didn't have satellites like we do. And an entire tank army went across on those floatable rollers and this kind of a portable bridge that they put over the Suez Canal and got behind the Egyptian Third Army and could have gone all the way to Cairo. It was at that time that the big powers, including Russia, said, we got to halt this thing. So they called on all the big powers, the United Nations, to call a halt to it. But the Israelis had run out of ammunition and spare parts. The Israelis were just desperate because they were fighting a war on two fronts once again. And so Nixon decided that the best policy would be to just transship weapons, ammunition, spare parts from forward NATO bases in places like Bad Tölz in Germany, Austria, and along the line in Germany, and not to send anything direct from the United States. But of course, the Arabs got wind of it. What do? They clamped down an oil embargo. Do you remember waiting 4 hours in line for a tank of gas? I didn't personally, because Bill Evans, a buddy of mine, would take my car and go wait in line for me, but in 1973, we had to wait in line a long time because the Arabs clamped down an oil embargo when our government said they would never do that. Do you suppose that's a possibility of our times? Could the Arabs do that, you suppose? It absolutely boggles the mind when you look at the accuracy, the intricacy, the details in biblical prophecy relative to the Middle East, to Israel, and to all that is happening in the world today. So, I want to just come back briefly to the question that I asked in the beginning. After Saddam, then what? Well, the United States is advised, and I'm sure they know this very well, that whatever kind of a government is put in place in Iraq must appear to be an Iraqi government that is a coalition of the Iraqi peoples. But guess who's going to be against that? The Shias to the south, around the southern part of Iraq. The Kurds to the north, who are agitating for a separate state. The Shias don't like the Sunnis, and the Sunnis don't like the Shias. And the Sunnis are a minority, but are actually in control because of Saddam and all of his clan from Tikrit, and all of the people that are, of course, being given great gifts. As a matter of fact, just recently, Saddam gave everyone, some of the upper-level officials, a brand new car, just the other day, out of his largesse. And also that buys a lot of loyalty. Along with it, he said, be sure to keep these canisters in your closet, and told people that they need to hide some of these things in their private homes, which we know that they've been reporting. So all I can say is there isn't going to be, folks, there isn't going to be a happy outcome even if we win the war. Just put that down and don't ever forget it. It isn't going to make the Islamic nations feel very good toward the United States if we go to war and devastate the Iraqis. It isn't going to make a lot of the Iraqis real happy, although most of them want to get rid of Saddam. But they'd like to do it themselves. So, what's going to happen after Saddam? Who knows? If Israel is dragged into this war and nuclear exchanges occur, if Turkey is dragged in, then so will Greece be dragged in. And so will Saudi Arabia and all the other nations in the Middle East. We are living in times where the unknown could occur almost at any moment. We were not prepared for 9/11. We were so stunned and shocked and traumatized by that occurrence, and so will we be if a suitcase-sized nuclear weapon is detonated in downtown Los Angeles. We are no more ready psychologically, emotionally, for something like that to occur than we were on the 10th day of September in 2001. But we are living in a time of the imminent fulfillment of many biblical prophecies, and all I can promise after Saddam, chaos.